This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey, everybody. I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session. Thanks, everybody, for joining today. I have a guest on the podcast, Dr. Drew Rickson, who is an optometrist at a VA medical center, and we're talking about glaucoma. Dr. Rickson, Drew is a member of the Optometric Glaucoma Society, and he is a leader in the American Academy of Optometry Glaucoma Section. And in actuality, he's a rising leader in optometry with regards to glaucoma, and you should be on the alert to look out for him in CE lectures, advisory boards, advice, particularly with this topic. And so I'm very excited to have him join us today to talk about really what optometry has been doing for quite a long time, which is managing the lion's share of glaucoma patients out there. Hi, Drew.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me on. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we as the primary eye care profession, especially the population trends with patients getting older and older and older, we're going to see more and more of this disease. And we need to be the primary managers, screening as well as management going forward to help capture this and prevent blindness. That's our role.
How did you first develop an interest in glaucoma?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I think, you know, I had done a residency in family practice. I'd come down to Tennessee specifically at the time. I'm from Connecticut originally. And I'd come down to Tennessee because the laws were so much more all-encompassing. I think it was more aligned with what the philosophies were that I was taught at Pennsylvania College of Optometry. So when I came down here, you know, I saw a whole bunch of everything in family practice, and it was kind of like a jack of all trades, master of none sort of scenario. When I got over to the Memphis VA, I realized that, you know, there actually were a lot of deficiencies I had in glaucoma. And, you know, in Memphis, where we're about, you know, Memphis proper probably has about 70% African-American, we do have just epidemiologically a higher percentage of glaucoma patients. So something that you absolutely have to master in order to just do the best you can for your patients.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I totally get that. What about, you know, your efforts in the, as I mentioned earlier, in the academy and OGS, you know, how did you really raise your hand and say, hey, I want to be more involved and really, you know, get recognized?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to someone about that the other day about saying, you know, people say all the time, oh, you know, how's that person able to do that? Or they must have caught breaks, all the other stuff. And the reality is, most of the time, it's just that person's willing to step up and volunteer. And I think I was really nervous about doing that at first, because you sometimes wonder, are you capable of actually having success and actually contributing? And all I did was I went to the glaucoma section meeting. And then it was like, hey, you're going to do this. And I got involved with the education standpoint and met a lot of really superior optometrists. We've got a lot of really good talent within our profession, and they've helped kind of mentor me. And then to me in glaucoma, the ultimate is really getting into Optometric Glaucoma Society. I think that's by far the top of the line of what we have in the profession. Our glaucoma section and academy is really on the rise as well. I'm also pursuing my diplomate. I'll be sitting for my oral coming up. So to me, it's just like, if you have an interest, there is no shortage of opportunity, because most people are honestly not stepping up.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Sometimes you just have to raise your hand.
Absolutely.
And get involved and volunteer. And then sometimes many, many more doors open after you just get that first door opened.
Absolutely. Plus it kind of breaks down any barriers. And it kind of empowers you to realize you can do it. It's a matter of a cumulative process. You know, you just have to get going in the start. You know, that's the main thing.
So if you were talking to, say, I was a optometry student or resident, or I'm early in practice, or maybe I just I'm established, but I moved to an area that has a lot of glaucoma. I moved to a practice in which I'm going to be responsible. You know, what do you suggest to me? How do I get started? How do I develop some confidence in this disease state?
Yeah, I think it's just the knowledge that you've been trained appropriately within whatever school or college of optometry that you went to manage glaucoma. It's a matter of almost demystifying glaucoma as being something that, you know, we're really worried that someone's necessarily going to go blind. Most glaucomas are not going to be that massively or rapidly progressive that you can't at least kind of dip your toes in without creating harm for the patient. And so I think it's really important just to know that you're able to do it. And there's a lot of resources out there, you know, peer-to-peer resources. You know, I was looking at a survey that Review of Optometry did, and one of the number one barriers was actually equipment. So the main thing is I think investing in equipment is really, really important if you are going to invest in yourself and in your patients. And another one was insurance. And then the other one was literally, you know, just the barrier of not feeling comfortable with it. I think if I was going to talk to an early practitioner or a fourth year or a third year, I think it's a matter of establishing good habits early on. So again, I always go back to empowerment and challenging yourself. And once you challenge yourself, you'll be empowered to move forward. It's really important to start developing good habits when you're a third year or fourth year. So when it's one of these things like, oh, I just don't want to do gonioscopy. You know, we always joke around about if I wanted to clear a room of third year or fourth year interns, I'd say go do gonioscopy. But once they start doing that third or fourth gonio, it's like, okay, you know, although this is more challenging than it was in lab, I'm doing this. And it's just, it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy. You just need to get going. And again, if you are vigilant with this and you're careful and you do a good baseline examination, although you may not have the answer right away, if you're patient, you'll develop those skills. And then those will just build upon each other. It's just having that solid foundation.
So let's continue on that track in regards to gonioscopy specifically. So if I'm managing a patient, I don't know, say around age 50, and I diagnose them with primary open-angle glaucoma, so at some point I have done gonioscopy to say, yes, this patient's angle is open, but throughout this 50-year-old's lifetime, given there's no cure for glaucoma, that angle may not be open forever. So how frequently do you suggest that I repeat gonioscopy over this lifetime of this patient?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it would depend on, you know, if we're just talking about it, like a vanilla POAG situation. I mean, every couple of years. And I don't know that there's any standard of care, honestly, on repeating gonioscopy. I'd have to look at what payers would pay as well. I don't know if that's an annual thing. You know, not that that's our primary emphasis, but you obviously want to get paid for what you do. So I'd say, you know, some people will say, you know, every 5 years, every couple of years. For me, from just a practice standpoint, I actually do have our residents do it every single year. But that's trying to, again, establish those foundational skill sets. And I don't think that's, you know, creating harm for the patient either. So it really is a good question. I think it's, you know, what would it take for the angle to close over time in a 50-year-old that didn't have risk factors of, say, that lens growing and you know, starting to inhibit things. So I know, how do you usually approach that?
You and I are on the same page with regards to that. I honestly try to do it every year. And if for some reason I'm short on time or I'm having a really, you know, rough day with regards to patients piling up and I don't feel like I want to do it, or maybe the patient doesn't want to do it that day, I may do it every 24 months, but I try to do it every year.
Yeah. I mean, I think you just have to establish your own set of practice patterns. I'd have to look at American Academy of Ophthalmology practice patterns. I'm not sure that there is one for gonio, and I may just be ignorant on that, but.
So you mentioned optometric, and really all eye provider equipment is in specifically with glaucoma. And so I want to go down that path for a moment. One of the debates over the years, even long ago, used to be form versus function. And before the advent of OCTs, we had obviously our own eyes in fundoscopy looking at the optic nerve. We had retinal cameras in which we could take stereo optic nerve photos or sometimes just two-dimensional photos. And we might say to ourselves in the course of an exam, wow, it looks like this nerve is changing, but if the field wasn't worsening, then how aggressive do I need to be form versus function. And now we have OCT, which gives a very different, more in-depth look at the optic nerve and the optic neuropathy as things progress. And so the same question exists today and persists today. If I see progression on OCT, but the patient's function is not changing, how aggressive do I still need to be?
What do you think about that? There's been a huge paradigm shift over the last, I'm going to say 15 years, but let's say the last decade in that whole conversation. There was a really good paper that was done by the folks that were involved in the EMGT study and came out a couple of years ago. And they looked at structure versus function as far as the behavior. And they found that structure and function matched up. Like it was like one out of 306 patients or something like that. So it's a rarity, but it's also how those studies are framed, how they're developed. There's a good editorial that came out a couple of years ago that talked about structure versus function, and it titled it as the debate that does not need to be had, because these are complementary to each other. They're in different units. So one's linear units, namely, OCT, and one's logarithmic units, namely, visual fields. So, we need to not be arguing. We need to use them together. And so I think the most important thing is to integrate. We did a paper, myself and Lauren Risson, for Review of Optometry like 2 years ago, and it was called Visual Fields in the Era of OCT. And what I started out with the opening paragraph was, are visual fields still king? Is OCT king? Is one better than the other? Are they mutually exclusive, or should they be integrated? And by all means, they need to be integrated. It's just, do you have the software that actually easily integrates it and can be done in an efficient way, so that we're able to, just maximize what our abilities to take care of the patient is without getting overly confused? Because I think the more data you have, the more confounded you can be. And especially depends on how you use that data.
I remember distinctly when I used the OCT for the very first time. And then since that time point, I've had many different brands and many different scans. And I remember initially right out of the gate, really just feeling overwhelmed by what this instrument could do and really admitting to myself, wow, if I do this, I'm probably only doing it at 1% of this instrument's capability. And so do you think, for lack of a better way of questioning in this way, that an OCT can be a crutch for us? It can give us what some lecturers refer to as green, yellow, red disease, where when the machine, do we allow the machine to tell us what to do to a large and potentially dangerous extent?
Yeah, I think that's always an issue. I tell every resident, student, doctor, anytime I lecture, that the most important person or most important entity in that exam room is always the human. So the machines at this point should not be doing our job for us. Obviously, as AI comes down and deep learning, we'll be more and more successful as repeatability is concerned in helping us do our jobs. We still have to be the one driving the ship. I'm saying we got to be wagging the tail. The tail can't be wagging us. And so I think the utilization of OCT as the be all and end all without interpretation by the human is definitely risky. You mentioned the traffic lights, the red, yellow, green, and that's so deeply embedded in our psyches just with how we grow up in society. But these machines aren't perfect. There's reproducibility errors. There are operator errors. There are machine errors. There are patient errors. And there is some level of sophistication that's necessary in order to use these things correctly. It's a completely different language that I've continually learned every day, the various pratfalls that are involved in OCT. And so you have to recognize that. And when you're doing screening exams constantly, just because you achieved something that the machine's reference database gave you doesn't mean that the person has the disease. At the end of the day, and you mentioned this earlier, the clinical evaluation of the optic nerve should supplant everything in order to even decide whether you're doing a testing, and you as the human still needs to drive everything. So maybe too long of an answer, but...
No, but let me keep going, because I want to ask you the same topic, but in a little bit different way. One of the topics that I had on a podcast that's either been posted or upcoming is when I'm charting for a patient, I'm looking at, you know, documenting. I always consider, well, how might this look if viewed by somebody else?
Yeah.
And how might somebody else care for this patient if they were in my shoes today with the patient? And so if I have a patient that already has the diagnosis of glaucoma on their chart before I see them, and I'm seeing them and now I'm doubting the diagnosis, to me, I'm always thinking, well, you know, it's a lot harder to change and delete a diagnosis than it is to make one. And in this whole topic of green, yellow, red traffic lights on OCT, when everything is crazy red, sometimes a lot of us can be nervous to say, wow, I want to overrule this instrument.
Yeah.
Or I want to delete this diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, that's a constant issue. And I don't know that there's medical legal precedence for, you know, someone ultimately progressing that was, you know, diagnosed based on an instrument, and then someone clinically said, no, this person is, you know, they're a minus nine myope, and they're like a true axial myope, and then there's minification on the machine, and then it falsely, you know, dictates that there's red or you know, first percentile. You know, I mean, I think we have to go back to the fact that this is not a normative database that you're looking at. It's a reference database of, say, like 275 patients on Cirrus, you know, roughly. I think that you should still be the one that's empowered to make that decision. A little caveat to that, though, is if you get a patient that comes in and they're diagnosed with glaucoma and you're absolutely convinced they don't have glaucoma, I do think you have to tread lightly as far as how you're managing that patient, because you have to, you really have to kind of establish that relationship with them, because they're not going to necessarily trust you if they've been told that they have a, you know, vision threatening entity that they're going to go blind from. It's like, that's tough to overcome that emotional burden. So usually what I'll do is I'll kind of set the table and talk to them about how, you know, maybe our philosophies on glaucoma have changed. And as a result, it may be in the future, I may be able to actually take you off drops, but since I'm just seeing you for the first time, we need to gather more information. So you don't throw the other person under the bus. You acknowledge that something's been diagnosed and you kind of work your way through. So you're actually, you know, considering the patient from a holistic standpoint, just a thought as you ask that question.
Yeah, I get it. Well, let's say we have a patient of our own and our patient seems to be progressing despite our best efforts. And we really begin to wonder, is this, if the patient's on a topical treatment regimen, are they really, are they telling us the truth? Are they really taking these drops? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, just to be blunt, you don't, but you do. So I'll explain. So, you know, when you look at research, and a lot of it was done at Wilmer, what they found was that most patients do not have medication even on hand. From pharmacy data, they find that you can't tell whether or not someone's using their medications most of the time based on IOP. You can't tell based on calf color. You can't tell by asking them. And the reasons for that are mainly doctor-patient communication and then healthcare literacy that patients do not have. And so it's a matter of trying to develop the relationship where you demystify things for the patient, help them understand what's going on, make them more healthcare literate, and then hopefully empower them to have more success going forward. You know, the critical time frame for medication adherence is about 90 days, most studies show. So you really have to kind of, and it's maybe not a politically correct term, but you really have to essentially babysit them very stringently early on. And then you have to realize that a lot of the times the patients are not using their medication. The only way you're going to be able to determine whether or not you're having success or failure is based on those trend lines, both on function and structure. So if they're not progressing, you can pat yourself on the back whether they're using their medications or not. If they are progressing and they are using the medications, even though you can't verify, you have to step up and escalate your treatment. So it's a maddeningly frustrating thing. What they have shown is really beneficial It's just coming up with like an educational slide deck. And it's something I stole from the optometric glaucoma educators meeting. And David Friedman, who's up at, I think he's the glaucoma chair at Mass Eye and Ear now, he just put together a little slide. It's about a minute and a half. It breaks down glaucoma in a way that the average patient can understand, you know, with a different, I guess, vocab than we have. I mean, as doctors, we have a tremendously greater vocab. You have to distill it down to their level. And when you go through that, then you do kind of you ask them on the front end, then you tell, then you ask. And that's shown to actually improve adherence and improve that conversation. So to me, it's a matter of understanding that it's going to be really hard for you to assess adherence based on conventional methods we've used, because most of the time our biases and our beliefs are wrong based on the studies. So it's just building that relationship to try to maximize how you're actually having impact.
I love it. I'm totally going to remember that. All right, I got two more questions for you.
Yeah.
First is, so you have this patient that's progressing and you don't think it's a compliance issue, and maybe you've reached your maximum medical therapy for this individual. When do you initiate a referral to a glaucoma specialist, let's say, when you feel like it's out of your hands?
You know, I've always had a really low threshold on this. You know, backstory with me, and again, I have some biases, is my dad has exfoliation glaucoma, has been through multiple procedures. He's not able to drive anymore. I think if you look back through the records, you can point fingers, but I think this happens a lot of times is we tend to try to hang on. What the glaucoma community has tried to move more towards is the buzzword over the last 2-3 years has been interventional glaucoma. And they're even talking about proactive surgery now. So as we have these devices that are less invasive, relatively speaking, and are effective, and you have, sustained release drugs and all this other stuff, I think that as a profession, we should be moving more and more to having a lower threshold to refer out, given the fact that we know that these patients are not using their medications a lot of times. And let's face it, it's a symptomless disease for the most part until it gets really far along. I say this to my patients all the time. If I came in and hit your knee with a hammer and I gave you some Lortab, you would know the Lortab would work, right?
Right.
But if I tell you have a blinding disease that doesn't affect you at this time, and then I put you on medications, I make your eyes red, I give you deep inset eyes, I give you longer eyelashes, all of a sudden I have to put you on Xiidra because your ocular surface is horrible. Yeah, I just made your life worse.
Right.
And that's what you're dealing with. So we have to understand that from a human standpoint, there's a good rationale as far as why patients don't use their medications, because it's almost like the burden is worse than the benefit as far as what they're dealing with. So I think, again, I've always had a low threshold to send out for SLT first line my entire career. And I think that's part of the informed consent process. It's giving patients their options and then helping them to make informed decisions. But on a case that you're max medical therapy, you got to send out. You have to be able to detect that first, but you have to understand that glaucoma, although not entirely a surgical disease, has a really good surgical indication. And you want to make sure that you're taking care of that patient above all. So I don't know. I've always had a low threshold, and I definitely embrace the interventional glaucoma mindset. And at no point am I worried about losing my patients because this is not going to happen. They're still going to be seeing me for all the medical management once we've hopefully gotten them down to having less medication burden or similar medication burden, but not losing function.
Yeah, I think that's a professional and it definitely makes sense in that approach. I think the patients would understand that as well.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap up with, so for your next motivated optometry student or resident who wants to get into glaucoma as a area of interest, they don't know where to start. So what might be one of the first thing or things that you direct them to refresh on or read?
Yeah, reading material is always interesting now as we're sitting here doing a podcast. The one thing I would tell you is, since visual fields are still a huge portion of our game, effective perimetry is an absolute must read. It should be available in PDF form online for free. Most schools will provide that for their students. And it really is an easy read. It's kind of tough to get over the hump of like, you really want me to sit down and read an entire book on perimetry? And the answer is actually yes. And it's actually way easier and more digestible than you think it would be. So I'd say reading material effective perimetry, I think from a just overall comprehensive stuff, gynioscopy.org, I think is a really awesome thing that Wallace Allward has put together. He's also put together the Iowa glaucoma curriculum, which is on you know, University of Iowa Ophthalmology's website. There's iGlaucoma, and that's by Constance Okeke, who is out of, I think, Virginia Eye Consultants. One of my friends used to work with her, and she's awesome. It's a YouTube channel. So all these things that they help, again, I know I'm redundant here on the demystification, but they help you feel more comfortable with how they present the materials, and it's not overly laborious or overly time consuming to digest these things. And I think they're really good for empowerment. And then lastly, just a plug for, I'm consulting for Telesight, which is a new peer-to-peer model. And essentially you could send us, you know, glaucoma information. We could talk real-time consulting. But you don't necessarily have to do that. It's just, you can seek out, you know, information from your peers. I think the bottom line is that we have to own glaucoma and optometry, and we're more than capable of owning glaucoma. We just have to do it. We're still at the point where 10% of ODs are writing 90% of glaucoma scripts. We need to do better. That population is going to double by 2050 of glaucoma patients.
You got it. Next year, the first millennial becomes presbyopic, and that's the enormous generation.
That's crazy.
So, yeah. This is going to be in front of us and in our offices and hands for the coming decades.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I know we're running out of time here, but I looked at the San Francisco match data for a lecture like a year or two ago, and that's ophthalmology's residency program matching, and they're flat. They've been flat for about the last 10 years as far as people that are going into ophthalmology. So, you know, it's up to us. It's not that ophthalmology can't handle some of it, but they need to be handling the surgical aspect of it. Because quite frankly, they probably won't be able to handle the volume that we're going to have to handle. So it's not a matter of, do we want to step up? We need to step up. There's a healthcare aspect to this where we need to get the job done as primary eye care physicians.
I love it. Thank you so much, Drew, for joining me today. It was definitely my pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for all that you do with glaucoma. I'm definitely going to take some of this information myself to get better, as I hope all the listeners do as well.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.